This is Think Inclusive. I'm Tim Villegas. Every week we bring you conversations about inclusive education and what inclusion looks like in the real world. And this episode is about something we at MCIE get asked about a lot when we are talking with districts about inclusive practices. How do we grade? After a quick break, Dr. Thomas Guskey breaks it down for us.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This week, I'm coming to you from San Antonio at the CEC conference. And if you don't know what CEC stands for, it's the Council for Exceptional Children. The CEC is the largest international professional organization dedicated to improving the success of children and youth with disabilities and or gifts and talents. And no, I'm not presenting this year, but I am very interested to learn what educators are saying about inclusion, especially here. It is no secret that not everyone is aligned with what I would call our definition of authentic inclusive education, that all really does mean all. You don't have to look very far to see a school district continuing the practice of segregating learners with disabilities into separate disability-specific classrooms. But I'm an optimistic person. And from looking at the schedule, I'm glad to see so many sessions centered around inclusion, inclusive practices, and equity. Now, on to our guest. Dr. Thomas Guskey is Professor Emeritus in the College of Education at the University of Kentucky. A University of Chicago graduate and former middle school teacher, he served as an administrator in Chicago Public Schools and was the first director of the Center for the Improvement of Teaching and Learning, a national educational research center. He is author and editor of over 28 books and over 300 published articles and book chapters. His most recent books include Engaging Parents and Families in Grading Reforms, Implementing Mastery Learning, and Instructional Feedback. On this episode of Think Inclusive, we delve into the complexities of traditional grading systems and explore the potential of standards-based grading to revolutionize how learners are evaluated. Dr. Guskey discusses the gaps between grading knowledge and practices, and how the reliance on traditional models has impacted education, highlighting the need for changes in assessment and grading methods. Do you believe that all children with and without disabilities deserve to reach their potential through inclusive education? If so, you'll love Brooks Publishing, the premier publisher of books and tools on early childhood, special education, communication and language, and more. Brooks Publishing has been partnering with top experts for over 30 years to bring you the best resources for your classroom, clinic, and home. To learn more, visit brookspublishing.com to browse their catalog, read their blog, and sign up for their newsletter. Brooks Publishing, helping you make a difference in the lives of all children. And just for Think Inclusive listeners, visit bit.ly/brooks-0324 to put your name in to win a copy of The Facilitator's Guide to the Paraprofessionals Handbook for Effective Support in Inclusive Classrooms. It's a second edition, and it's by Dr. Julie Costin and Dr. Kate McLeod. We will be taking names until the end of the month, so go ahead and look for that link in the show notes. And now, my interview with Dr. Thomas Guskey. Tom Guskey, welcome to the Think Inclusive podcast.
Thanks, Tim. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I can't go on without saying that I'm just so thankful that we're able to talk, even though we had some technical issues. We're both being very flexible today.
That's true. These sort of things require that little flexibility.
Exactly. The reason I reached out in the first place, Tom, was because I heard that you were the person to talk to about grading. And grading is an issue and a topic that gets brought up a lot in our work at the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education. In fact, we were in Arkansas doing a all-day workshop for educators, and people wanted to ask me about grading, and I said, I don't, that's not my wheelhouse. So I'm hoping that this conversation is going to be enlightening, not only for me and our organization, but for a lot of educators, because I think especially in the realm of how to make inclusion and inclusive education work, grading is a big topic. So because it's a complex issue, I wondered if the best way to start would be, you know, historically educators have graded learners in a particular way, traditionally. So what's the best way to understand how schools have traditionally graded learners?
Well, there is a long history of research in the area of grading. In fact, in 2016, the American Education Research Association, which is the premier organization of education researchers in the world, actually, was celebrating its 100th year anniversary. As a part of that celebration, they put out a call to the field to different researchers and scholars, requesting that they take on the challenge of trying to review the research in these different aspects of education that have been conducted over that past century. So together with my friend Susan Brookhart, we put together an amazing team of researchers and scholars who had really spent a lot of time looking at grading issues over that time, and were able to develop an article that was then published in the Review of Educational Research, the organization's premier research journal. Following that, we were approached by ASCD, asking if we could extend that work and talk about the modern implications of it and practical implications of that work. So we developed a book that we entitled What We Know About Grading. And one of the things that we discovered in putting this together is that there is a very long tradition of research in grading, but very little of that research has found its way into practice. In fact, it led us to conclude that there's probably not another area in education where there's a larger gap between our knowledge base and our practice than in the area of grading. We do seem to be bound by tradition, more in grading than in any other aspect of education today. It's rather amazing in that way.
So what would be the, like you said that there's a gap between what we know and the practice. So like, what is a way for us to understand how we have traditionally graded, right, and what the best practices are? Because I'm assuming what you mean by traditional grading is that we use letter grades, or that we, you know, grade on the curve, or, you know, I mean, just for example, right. My oldest daughter is a senior in high school, mm-hmm. and she is taking I'm not going to name the course because I don't want any identifiers, but, because you know, people listen to this and they're like, I know who you're talking about.
yes. Right.
you know, so she's taking a course, and let's say the teacher is, grading on a curve. And mm-hmm. it was amazing to me that, wow, there's teachers that are still grading on a curve. And,
yes.
and so what does that mean? Like, why are we still grading on a curve, and what's the alternative?
Yeah. Well, one of the dilemmas we have in education today is that almost all school districts throughout the United States and pretty much throughout the world are using some form of a computerized grading program. It is among the fastest selling and best selling software in education today. There are over 50 different computerized grading programs available to educators today throughout the United States, but there are three that pretty much dominate the market. But all these computerized grading programs are based on very traditional models of grading. They are based on what schools have sort of always done. The problem is that when those are implemented, it makes change and innovation extremely difficult, because you have to find workarounds within this complex reporting system that your district has purchased, which in some ways can reduce the workload for teachers by making bookkeeping a bit more efficient. But it perpetuates these sort of traditional practices for which we've got lots of evidence that indicate don't work. I mean, a very quick example. There were some researchers, their names were Starch and Elliott. They were concerned about the sort of consistency in teachers' grading practices. And would different teachers looking at the same body of evidence or the same sample of student work graded exactly the same way? So they, to test this out, they took two compositions that had been written by high school students. They made copies, and they sent those to 200 high school English language arts teachers. The directions were simply that they asked the teachers to assume these papers came from their students and to grade them according to whatever criteria or whatever standards they would use for their students. Starch and Elliott got the papers back from the teachers and found the grades were all over the place. Mm-hmm. They asked the teachers to assign a letter grade and a percentage grade to both of the papers, and they found that in terms of letter grades, 15% of the teachers gave the papers a grade of A, which was the highest grade possible. 13% gave failing grades to exactly the same papers, every grade in between. In terms of the percentage grade, on the first paper, they ranged from 50 to 98. On the second, they ranged from 64 to 97. So Starch and Elliott published their study. But as soon as their study came in, people criticized them, said, well, first of all, you chose writing. Writing is a very subjective judgment in the first place. Not everybody agrees with what writing is. Second, you chose high school English language arts teachers. Everybody knows they're kind of a crazy lot. You can't trust them anyway. so what Starch and I did in response was they took two math papers and repeated their same study. And when they got the papers back from math teachers, they found greater variation in the grades of math teachers than the English language arts teachers. And people always wonder how that can be. Well, what Starch and Elliott found is that many of the math teachers just kind of correct answers because they felt that's what students would have to do when they took these large-scale assessments. But many of the math teachers gave partial credit. Mm. How they gave the partial credit very drastically. I mean, some took offer tables, some didn't. The grades were just all over. And so those results typically don't surprise people very much. I mean, it's very similar to what we're experiencing today as we try to have teachers grade portfolios or demonstrations or projects, exhibits of student work. What they find surprising is that Starch and I published their studies in 1912. I mean, we've known about this for a long time.
Oh, wow.
What happened was that when Starch and Elliott and other researchers in the early 1900s were making these discoveries about the inconsistency in teachers' grading, We did see changes in grading practices, sort of overall. In particular, there was a reduction and a sort of diminishing of the use of percentage grades. People found that it was very difficult for us to have any consistency among teachers when you had a grading scale with 101 discrete categories of student performance, two-thirds of which typically noted failure. And so when you look historically, that's when we started using fewer categories. The letter grade system was developed at the time to 1920s, 1930s. We had fewer grade categories, a greater consistency existed among teachers. We started thinking about in 1940s, developing more specific criteria for classes. The work of Ralph Tyler at the University of Chicago was instrumental in this. His book on basic principles for curriculum instruction had a profound influence on having educators become more focused in their instruction and developing greater transparency in what it is that one students learn to be able to do. And that sort of continued until we hit the late 1980s and 1990s, because we started using computers for grading. And the companies that were developing the computer programs, the software engineers, were not familiar with this background. They were, they've been trained as software developers, and they liked the percentage system. It's, 101 categories, very similar to money, easy to divide in halves and quarters and tenths. And so we had this resurgence, this return to percentage grades without any justifiable defense for it. When had we taken the time to look back, we would have found that we knew this wasn't going to work when we started. And so it's this reliance on technology that hasn't been formulated with the knowledge of what our research has provided to us, without the knowledge base. This led us astray and caused stuff in different directions. Now, in terms of grading on the curve, it's interesting you should bring that up, because of all the areas we looked at, the one thing for which we have the most sort of extensive research is that you really need to grade students according to what they've learned and what they're able to do, not according to the relative standing among classmates. That means you don't grade on the curve. When you do that, there are a number of really negative consequences that follow. In particular, it tells you nothing about what the students have learned and are able to do. I mean, everybody in the class could then do miserably. It's just some did less miserably than others. It makes learning very competitive, because the students have to compete against each other for the few scarce rewards the teacher's going to give out. It diminishes any sense of cooperation or collaboration among students, because if you help someone else, it's detrimental to your chances for success. Because for every student that moves up, another student has to move down. It actually diminishes the relationship of teachers to students, because now as soon as the teacher starts helping one student, you're interfering in the competition. You're not providing that assistance to others, and they is perceived as being unfair. So we do have extensive research that says the teachers do really need to grade students according to what they've learned and what they're able to do. You grade according to the curriculum and your learning goals there, not according to a student's standing in classmates.
And I would think that if you have an educator who is teaching a lesson and in over half of the learners take an assessment and fail, that's probably a problem.
That is a real problem. And I think that one of the things in the area of assessment we're trying to emphasize is we use assessments as learning tools. It's a learning tool not only for the students, but for the teachers. So, for example, and this happens to me, I have times when I'll give a quick assessment in a class that I'm teaching, and if I come to a question that other students in the class miss, that's not a student learning problem. That's a teacher problem. And what that communicates to me is, no matter how I taught it, it just didn't come across. And I share with teachers that I'm not very good at predicting that. At one time I thought I was, but I've discovered I'm not at all. There are times I teach lessons and I think it's magnificent. I think, wow, I was on today. This was really great. Then I asked my students about it and they didn't get it. And what we're trying to emphasize with teachers is that if students didn't get it, it didn't work. Because whether or not it works is not defined by what the teacher does. Whether it works is defined by what the students are able to do.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
There's some talk about moving towards a standards-based grading, and I'm not exactly sure what that would even look like. But what is standards-based grading? How is that different than what we are, what we experience traditionally in schools right now?
Right. Well, it is true. There are, you know, there's tremendous press across the nation to move toward a standards-based grading, or what some places are calling a competency-based grading. Some people want to argue about the differences between those, but they're, I believe, trivial at best, and they're making artificial distinctions that aren't really necessary or helpful. And the problem is that if you talk to 20 experts on standards-based education, you get 18 different definitions about what it is. Mm-hmm. And that's led to some of the confusion about this overall. The premise of the idea is that it's focusing on this notion of transparency in all aspects of the teaching learning process. When we think about the teaching learning process in the most general terms, there are four basic elements. There's your curriculum, which is what you want students to learn to be able to do. There is instruction, which is how we help students acquire that knowledge and skill. There's assessments, and that's how we determine if students have acquired knowledge and skills. And then there's grading reporting, which is how we communicate their learning success or learning shortcomings to the students and to parents and families and to others. The basic premise of a standards-based or competency-based approach is there has to be transparency in those four elements and alignment across them. That in any subject area, in any academic discipline, there is no limit to what students can learn. I mean, learning in any academic discipline is infinite, but a curriculum is finite. When we define a curriculum, we specify within that entire domain the things that we want students to learn to be able to do. Once we specify the curriculum, then our job as educators becomes letting all students learn that. And not just learn some of it, but learn it all excellently. I mean, we would never define a curriculum to include some things that we would think students couldn't learn or shouldn't be able to learn. Or that certain students should learn. Hmm. When we define a curriculum, we're specifying these are the things we want all students to learn excellently. Then we need to make sure our instruction is aligned with that we're teaching students those things we consider to be important. We need to make sure our assessments are transparent and are aligned with that. You don't test students on things they haven't been taught. It just doesn't align with it. It's not appropriate. It wouldn't be a valuable teaching and learning approach. And finally, then we need to report those results in terms of those specified learning goals, how well students learn and review those things. And if they haven't, what we can do to overcome any shortcomings or any misgivings they have in those understandings, to make sure they do learn it well. So I think the whole premise of a standards-based or competency-based approach is that notion of transparency. Let's be clear about what we want the kids to learn. Let's teach them those things. Let's assess them accordingly and report it in that same way that it is transparent.
Mm-hmm. For those schools that are moving towards this style of grading, like how I'm just imagining someone listening and going like, well, okay, but how does that translate to high school transcripts? Because you have all of these learners who are scrambling for, you know, over 4.0 grade point average, and you know they're trying to use that to get into an elite school. And like, how does that affect grade point average, or is it a completely separate system?
Right. No, they're very much related, but there are, and I've described in some of the things that I've written, there are some necessary prerequisites that schools must establish before they can move to a standards-based or competency-based approach. The first is you must be clear about your purpose for grading. Schools need to take time to establish a purpose statement for grading so that can provide the foundation for all their policies and practices. And typically in this purpose statement, what they will indicate is that a grade should reflect accurately how well students have learned and are able to do, or how well they've achieved the particular learning goals we've set. And it might be to say to how well they're able to do it at this time or currently able to do it. And along with the purpose statement, they often include a statement that would say other aspects related to learning having to do with, you know, their behavior in school or their responsibility or other things are important, but we're going to report that separately from an academic achievement grade. So you establish that purpose first. Then the second thing is to make sure all of your policies align with that purpose. And so if you say that you want the grade to reflect what students have learned and been able to do at this time, what that does is it eliminates averaging. Because what you're saying is, we don't care where you were at the beginning marking period. We want the grade to reflect where you are right now. But you cannot move to those changes in those policy practices until you have the purpose statement. That has to come first. And so you establish that purpose statement. You print it on the report card. You have it as the opening policy and the opening paragraph in your policy statement. So that's number one. Number two is to establish a more reasonable number of grade categories. We find that there is one of the major elements in getting consistency among teachers in looking at a common sort of body of evidence and coming up with the same grade is to limit the number of categories. You're going to get it down to about 4 to 6 categories. You just can't do it with 101. There's just no way you can be consistent at. Mm-hmm. And then the third aspect is that we have to move away from a single grade for everything to multiple grades. Typically, when teachers are grading according to criteria, there are three different types of criteria that they consider. The first we've labeled product criteria, and products are just culminating demonstrations of what students are willing to be able to do. The second area is what we call process criteria. And process criteria are typically behaviors that don't represent learning, but enable the learning process. Hmm. So completing homework assignments, for example, is a process criteria. Formative assessments, process criteria. Engagement in class or class participation, process criteria. And finally, we have progress. With progress, you worry about not necessarily where they are, but how far they've come. Mm-hmm. Sometimes referred to as improvement grading or value-added grading. So a student could make fantastic progress, but still be achieving below grade level or course expectations. Mm-hmm. So we know that all three are important, but all three are distinct. What gets us into trouble is when we combine all three of those into a single grade. because then the grade's impossible to interpret. The highly responsible low achiever gets the same grade of C as the irresponsible high achiever. And so the idea is that instead of combining those into a single grade, you report them separately on the report card and on the transcript. Now, that sounds so novel and unique to schools throughout the United States, but what's interesting is that if you go north to Canada, Canadian schools have been doing this for decades.
Really?
They don't give a single grade. They give a band of grades. There's an achievement grade, and they can use that for grade point average or anything like that that you want. But then there's a separate grade for class participation, a separate grade for collaboration in class, a separate grade for completing homework. Now, when I first saw their system, I said, "Wow, it looks great, but it looks like so much extra work." And they turned back to me and said, "It's easier than what you silly people do in the States. We collect the same information as you. We just don't worry about combining it at the end." And so all those fights you have about how you weight stuff and how you consider this combination, we don't deal with it. We keep it separate. And the teachers there love it because they find kids take homework more seriously when they get a separate grade for homework. It's no longer considered as part of the achievement grade. They also like it because if a parent ever questions them about an achievement grade, all they do is say, "Well, look over here. Maybe if your child started completing the homework a bit more regularly, or maybe if they started participating in class more regularly, the achievement grade would go up." Parents like it because it gives a profile of performance of their students. The college universities love it because all grades are carried over to the transcript. And so if you're an admissions officer, would you rather have a straight A student that got there through diligence and hard work, or one that got there without even trying? I'm not saying one is better than the other. What I'm saying is that from our schools, we can't tell the difference. And from their schools, you can.
That is really interesting. So hypothetically, you could have a situation where a learner has a very high... did you say, is it product? Is that was the product process in progress? Is that what it was?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. So you have a very high, quote unquote product, grade, mm-hmm. And, not so great for process. And that is an interesting contrast between one that would maybe have high marks in all three categories.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I see that now.
Well, it's becoming an even more important issue when we deal with issues of equity. For example, coming out of COVID, many schools found that there's a tremendous increase in the number of failing grades. School districts like in Minneapolis and Salt Lake City, in San Francisco and San Diego areas, tremendous increases. I mean, number of failing grades among students was increasing like three and four times what they had seen before. When they began analyzing these grades, and especially when they began pulling out these non-achievement factors and putting them separately, it cut the number of failing grades by more than half. These kids were learning, it's just that they were getting low grades because they weren't turning in homework in time or weren't doing the homework. And oftentimes these were due to factors over which they didn't have any control. And so what this does is it brings greater accuracy and greater meaning to the grade. It also brings greater equity to the whole grading process.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the three things that really need to be in place before you consider going to a standards-based approach, which would mean taking those subject area product grades and breaking them down in different components. And so that instead of one overall grade for language arts, I might give separate grades for reading, writing, listening, speaking, and language skills. And that's what the standards-based or competency-based approach would do. But before we can get to that, you have to be able to pull out those non-achievement factors, reduce the number of grading skills, and have a clear purpose.
Do you have any idea of how prevalent this practice is currently with the standards-based grading in the United States, I mean?
Yeah, I do not know. I mean, it's very hard to get those data as to how many are actually doing it. We did a survey recently where we had looked at school districts that had attempted to do it and failed. There were terrible resistance, had to abandon the process completely. And they failed, actually, as we looked at this, for reasons that could have been anticipated. And oftentimes they did things in ways that were advised, they were advised to do, by very prominent consultants who were really well-intentioned in this process, but maybe didn't understand the implementation process, didn't understand the community well, didn't understand the attitudes and dispositions of the family or families in that area. And so if you can be more thoughtful about how you go about the implementation process, especially by looking at parents and families, not as resistors, but as allies for you and meaningful partners in the change process, you can meet much greater levels of success.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when you talked about the process of change, I'm reminded that, the information around implementation science, I'm certainly not an expert at all, but in our own work with system change and school transformation, around inclusive practices, you know, there's definitely a process to, you know, making change in a system. So I'm wondering if you see that in, you know, as far as the school districts moving toward a different system, like, isn't it really just a systems change issue?
No, you're absolutely right, Jim. In fact, I have a new book that's coming out next month on engaging parents and families in grading reforms. And there's an entire chapter there devoted to what you described, the change process. And when we think about change in education, and especially change through the professional learning experiences for educators, especially teachers, generally everybody agrees there are three sort of major areas of change we're trying to impact. One, we want some change in teachers' attitudes and beliefs. We want them to accept inclusion as a good idea. We want them to think about grading and doing different ways. We want them committed to new instructional approaches. Second, we want some changes in their practice. We want them to do things a bit differently. And of course, we want some changes in student learning. We want students to learn better. Everybody sort of agrees on those being the three major areas of change we're trying to impact. But the question I raised some years ago was, in what order do those changes occur? Did they don't happen simultaneously? And if you're going to be successful as a change agent, you really need to think about that order, because you want to know where to put your time and energy. So I was able to find a very long and distinguished history in education, especially in professional learning for educators, that was based on the idea that the order of change is attitudes and beliefs come first, that leads to change in their practice and results in change in student learning. And I was able to trace this back to the work of some early change theorists, Kurt Lewin, for example, who wrote in the 1930s and 40s, based many of his ideas on psychotherapeutic models. Unfortunately, all of our research on teacher change shows that's not the way it works. But the more typical order of change is practices first, student learning second, attitudes and beliefs last. And the reason that is so is that it's experience that shapes the attitudes and beliefs. It's not the other way around. And so you're never going to be successful at trying to change people's attitudes and beliefs directly. What you have to do is you need to focus on changing your experience. The same order of change holds for students. So that instead of saying, I want students to develop a growth mindset, I want them to feel responsible, I want them to develop a greater sense of agency for it, and I'm going to put them in classes to show them how they should do this. The impact of that is modest at best. What you need to do is show students in a learning situation how they can be successful. Provide them with strategies for success. Show them that when they implement these strategies, that they on their own are responsible for the conditions of success, and they can do it. And when they gain that experience, then the attitudes and beliefs start to change. The same actually holds true for parents and families. All these schools that have tried to change the attitudes of parents and families directly have met with modest success at best. We have a major effort going on here in Kentucky, though, where we approached it quite differently. Several years ago, a group of school districts in the state came to us here at the university wanting to for help and assistance in some of the grading reform efforts. So we brought everybody together in a summer institute that we held here at the university. And those teachers worked to develop purpose statements. They were going to go to a letter grade system of five categories instead of percentage grades. They were going to pull out these non-academic factors. We put them separately. Then they broke down the students for it. We did not spend a lot of time orienting parents to this. What we did instead is the teachers that had taken part in the summer institute went back and they worked with their colleagues, and so everybody was in line. When you change grading, you pretty much have to do it school-wide because it's something that you're mm-hmm. required to school-wide. It pretty much has to be done that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what we did for the first two marking periods in the coming year is we sent home two report cards. We sent home the traditional one that parents were accustomed to getting, and that was, a single letter grade for each class. And then we sent home our new one. In our new report card, we put the teacher's photographs on the report card for every class. And this wasn't our idea. We stole this from what we found taking place in many Canadian schools. We pulled out the non-achievement factors. We put them separately. And then we extended the comments section. So we had class comments and individual comments. So for two marking periods, the parents got both report cards. After the second marking period, all the school districts here in the state of Kentucky reported on a quarterly basis. So halfway through the school year, we surveyed the parents in these districts and said to them, we don't have the resources to keep sending you two any longer. We're going to send you only one, but you get to pick. Whichever report card you want is the one we will send you. Hmm. Do you know almost all of our parents chose a new one? Hmm. We have remarkable parent support just because it's better. I mean, we changed their experience. And so all the resistance that could have come about when parents saw what we were doing and saw how it was helpful to them, it gave them additional guidance on what they were looking for from the school. It was remarkable, the kind of support that we had for it, because we focused on changing the experience first, and then the attitudes of please follow. Mm.
That's powerful. That's really powerful. Mm-hmm. Well, we are running up to the top of the hour, so I want to make sure I get one more question, and is that okay?
Sure. Yeah, of course.
Okay. So for our listeners, a lot of our listeners are teachers. And a lot of them are interested in inclusive practices, specifically surrounding learners with more extensive support needs. We get this question a lot about, especially in high school, if a learner has an intellectual disability or maybe sort of more extensive support needs, and the school team or educators, they're not used to having a learner with that type of profile in a science class, a biology class, or, you know, a language arts mm-hmm. class in high mm-hmm. school. And the question is like, well, how does grading look like? What does grading look like for that learner, especially if maybe they're part of that 1% in a state that takes alternate assessment, or maybe they have modified activities. Is that something that you have any thoughts about?
Sure. actually, together with a former colleague of mine, Dr. Leon Young, we wrote a book about this. And what we advocate in this book is that teachers at all levels have to understand that when students come with those sort of special needs, we need to make adaptations for them within the instructional framework in order to provide an adequate and appropriate instructional program for them. But those adaptations take one of two forms. There are accommodations and there are modifications. Now, accommodations are a kind of adaptation that is made where we're just trying to level the playing field for students. And so, for example, those of us who wear eyeglasses, I mean, they are an accommodation. They don't give us superpowers in learning. They don't make learning any easier for us. They just allow us to learn in the same way that students with more visual acuity would be able to learn. When an accommodation is made to allow a student to learn on their level playing field, no change needs to be made in terms of grading. So, for example, if you have a child that is visually impaired in a science class, and the science exam is read to that student, and they respond orally, there's no reason to change the grading. I mean, you're still going to have the same learning goals and the same expectations for that student. Now, it could be that a group of educators, typically composed of special educators, regular classroom teachers, parents, and families, part of it too, look at the instructional program and say, based upon this child's learning history, we believe that it's going to be very difficult for them to succeed given these particular learning goals. And so we need to change the goals. We need to provide goals that are reasonable for this particular child. That's a modification. And when you change the goals, then you do need to change the grading. You're going to grade according to those goals, but when the grade is reported, you're going to put a little asterisk by the grade and just say it's based on modifications. You don't specify what the modifications are that you would do in an IEP or some other instruction program for it. You don't do it on the report card, you don't do it in transcript. Just indicate that based on modifications. Mm-hmm. And so, but the other thing we have to help all educators understand is sometimes you'll read these books or articles where they have a list of things and saying, these are accommodations and these are modifications. And they're all wrong. Because whether it is a modification or an accommodation really depends on the learning goal. Mm. So if I read the science exam to a student and they respond orally to those questions, that's an accommodation in science. If I read it to them and I'm measuring reading comprehension, well, that's different. And so you can't label any particular action as an adaptation or accommodation, modification. It depends on learning goal. It depends on what you're trying to achieve with the student. And so it's just for thoughtful educators to make reasonable decisions about that based upon the needs of students, it really becomes important.
Yeah. I think that sometimes too, it becomes like, well, you know, accommodations are quote unquote better than, like, there's a value judgment on, but it really is more, you know, it's supposed to be individualized. So it depends on the learner. And if that's what the learner needs, then that's what they should get, right?
Exactly. Yes. We are, you know, we're compelled by law to provide an instructional program in which the child can experience success. And so those require reasonable judgments on the part of not a single individual. We're a group of people who are coming together here, all with that student's best interest in mind, trying to design an appropriate instructional program. So it's based on the individual needs of the student and on the curriculum, the learning goals, and then you make the adaptations accordingly. But it's not an accommodation is better or worse. It's just it's adapted to that student for that particular learning goal.
Right, right. What book was that with Leanne?
It's called, let's see here. Grading Exceptional Learners. I think, let me pull this up here quickly. It's going well. Let's see. We've got Grading Exceptional and Struggling Learners by Corwin Press. It's Young and Gusky, 2012.
Great. Oh, wow. I was not aware of this. We mm-hmm. love Leanne Young. She was one of the authors on the Our Students, Your Students, My Students, I think. And that's a great, that's one of
yes
the resources that we use when we're working with school districts. So fantastic.
Yeah, she's done a lot of work in the area of inclusion, and her new organization on inclusive education is very successful in helping school districts kind of bring about those necessary changes.
After a short break, the mystery question.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
When you have to study for a test, this relates to our discussion kind of.
Yes.
What's a successful method for you? How would you study for a test? Like if you were a student.
Well, that's very relevant actually to our conversation, because the way I studied. And the way most teachers, if they think back to their own learning history study, is that we don't study what we think is important. We don't study what we think is stressed in the book or the materials. We study what we guess teachers are likely to ask on quizzes and tests. And most of us are successful in our educational career for that very reason. We become very good at guessing what our teachers are going to ask on quizzes and tests. Learning becomes a guessing game. And so you're always trying to anticipate or outwit your teachers, and some teachers probably take pride in their ability to outguess their students. I think that one of the things we're pressing for, as we talked about transparency in these education issues, is for that guesswork to be taken out of the learning process, to be very explicit about what it is we want students to learn. We've all had the experience of studying very hard for a quiz or a large test or examination in a class, and going in to take the exam, and as a teacher, professor hands it out, reading it and saying, oh my goodness, this isn't what I studied. We've all had that experience. And typically that teaches us two things. The first is it teaches us that hard work and effort don't pay off in school, because we worked really hard for that test and it really meant nothing. And the second thing it taught us was, you can't trust teachers. Those are not the lessons we want to be communicating to our students. But we've suffered for so long on this mistaken idea that tests have to be secret, that it's somehow unfair to let students know what's going to be in the test. Well, where did that come from? I mean, I work in an environment, people pay me to figure this out, and I just can't find it anywhere. And then the problem is, so long as it is a secret, then learning for kids becomes a guessing game. And I think as we move toward these standards-based or competency-based approaches and instill this notion of transparency across those major elements of the teaching learning process, that goes away. So what students are going to be studying is what was emphasized in class, what the teacher stressed. Go back to those lists of learning goals. Look at how you performed on different formative assessments in class. Those are your best preparation for those sort of culminating exams, those overall demonstrations of learning, the projects, whatever it is that's going to be used to determine your grade. review that formative information the teachers have been telling you all along. These are the things that are important for you to learn.
Amazing. And imagine if teachers regularly were transparent about what was going to be assessed, I would imagine that test anxiety would go way down.
Oh, of course. I mean, I use the example. I was, you know, when I was growing up, I was a swim instructor. And we have these different levels, you know, within the Red Cross, life-saving classes, swimming classes of students making progress. But we're very, very clear about what we expect. There's no secret to it. You want to let the kids know what it is. You can practice them doing those things. And it should never be a surprise for them. They know ahead of time going into it what the expectation is and what they have to do to succeed. So I think it's bringing that to all aspects of teaching and learning that's going to make it really, really much more effective.
Dr. Thomas Guskey, thank you so much for being on the Think Inclusive podcast. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Tim. Thank you so much for inviting me.
That's it for this episode of Think Inclusive. We appreciate you listening every week. And if you want to say hi, just email me at tvillegas, that's T-V-I-L-L-E-G-A-S, at mcie.org, or find us on the socials at think_inclusive. We're pretty much that everywhere. And I'm really liking Threads lately, so find us there too. Think Inclusive is written, edited, sound designed, mixed, and mastered by me, Tim Villegas. Thanks to Brooks Publishing for being a sponsor for this season. We appreciate you. Please check out those books on their website. Original music by Miles Kredich. Additional music from Melody. That's melod.ie if you are interested in checking them out. Thanks for your time and attention. And remember, inclusion always works. So I've been doing this podcast for over 10 years, 12, 13 years. And when I first started, I used Skype. This is exactly what I would do. I would actually record, I would call from my computer to a person's phone, and then we would record over the interview, you know, over the internet. And I would dump it right into my audio processor, my audio editor, and record it that way. So we've got all these newfangled tools now to make it quote unquote easier, but sometimes the old methods are just fine.
Yes, I understand that. In fact, I'm always discouraged by, it seems every organization I work with has been talked into using some other platform. I must have 20 different platforms loaded on my computer right now in order to communicate with you.
From MCIE.